The political world is becoming increasingly volatile and unpredictable, while at the same time having a profound impact on the lives of citizens across the globe. This is Polis Podcast, and I am Thomas Barton, the founder of Polis Analysis. Every week, I'll be in the virtual armchair with relevant experts from Polis teams to discuss the key developments shaping the political world. All we need is for you to join us on the virtual sofa.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of the Polis Podcast. I'm joined by Anne-Caroline, the lead analyst at Polis Analysis, who has an academic background in China and in Russia, primarily. And last time I was joined with Anne-Caroline was at the launch of the Polis Podcast, and we talked about US-China tensions. But today, we're going to have a conversation on tensions between the West and another rival power, which is Russia. So we're going to be looking at whether Western-Russian relations are entering a deep freeze or whether they will start to fall. So we're going to have a conversation about that for the next 20 minutes or so. So Anne-Caroline, to kick off, can you give a little bit of context for our listeners in terms of the current state of play when it comes to relations between Western powers and the Russian Federation?
Hey, Thomas. First of all, thank you for inviting me again on this podcast. I'm really excited. So what's new under the sun between the Russian Federation and the United States? I personally don't think there was a breakthrough in the relationship between the two powers since the arrival of Biden at the presidency. The two, obviously, Biden and Putin, they know each other. Biden has been working in the field of politics. It's been a long time since he's working on Russian matters. So he knows what to expect with Putin. So I would rather say that we know that the relationship is in a bad shape. Biden and Putin recently had a conversation about massive cyber attacks on US critical infrastructures. So you can see that you still have attempts to have talks and to sort of deepen cooperation where you can. And also there is one positive sign that was the recent lifting of the sanctions in May 2021 on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. As a reminder, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline is a project of a gas pipeline connecting Russia to Germany. And so the Biden administration lifting the sanctions, Blinken mentioned that basically lifting the sanctions were in the US national interests. So you can see that maybe the Biden administration is, as we mentioned during our first podcast, is trying to federate Western countries around the US, and thus is doing a gesture towards Germany and sort of renouncing selling natural gas to Europe, and is sort of leaving the floor to Russia, if I can put things that way.
Sure. And just quickly, Anne-Caroline, for the benefit of our listeners, Blinken is the American Secretary of State. The Nord Stream 2 issue in terms of gas supplies from Russia to Germany via the Baltic states is a huge project, and it's something that we're going to discuss a bit later on in our conversation. But just could you quickly, you've talked about the US's approach to relations with Russia. And of course, we know that Biden and Putin spoke recently at a summit. Can you quickly touch on the current state of relations between EU member states or European powers more generally and Russia, and whether, you know, the sort of relationship between the US and Russia has any spillover effects into how EU-Russian relations are conducting themselves.
I would say again, nothing is new under the sun, because we can see that the relationship between Russia and the EU are not in the best. They could have been in a better shape, I want to say. The EU recently released, I think it was a few days ago, they announced that they were continuing the sanctions against Russia and that it would run up until January 2022. So, you know, the sanctions that started after the 2014 annexation of Crimea. So you can see that basically where you can find space in which you can work with Russia, you take that space and you try to find ways to cooperate, but it's still sort of in a bad position, I would say.
Sure. And you mentioned sanctions, which is a really interesting topic. So let's now dive into the impact of West Russian relations on the lives of citizens. After all, that's what we're doing at Politanalysis. We're constantly trying to demonstrate how high-level geopolitical developments, like relationships between Western powers and Russia, can have a real impact on the lives of citizens. So you mentioned sanctions. What is the economic impact, Anne-Caroline, of the current state of the relationship between Western countries and Russia on citizens? So let's start with the sanctions piece. As you mentioned, ever since the Russian annexation of Crimea in Ukraine, the EU imposed sanctions on Russia, along with other powers. What is the impact of those sanctions on the economic livelihoods of Russian citizens, on the performance of the Russian economy, versus the impact on the economies of Western powers and the Western citizens?
Yes, well, I recently came across some estimation from different economists, and I found that Western sanctions against Russia from 2014 and 2018 covered something like a fifth of the Russian GDP, which is quite important. And when you have a look at the EU-West sanctions, you can see that the EU, but also US and Canada, imposed sanctions that targeted or prohibited investments or deals, and is mainly restricting the opportunities in the banking sectors or in sensitive or strategic sectors such as arms or weapons deals. As a result of this, so you can see that you have less maneuver in the banking sector. But from the Russian side, as Russia decided to strike back, you know, so Russia has limited the imports of EU agricultural products, which meant that less products were available on the market for Russian consumers. And at the same time, it has risen the price of these imported products on the Russian market, which sort of put down the purchasing power of the Russian. But one positive aspect you can mention is that the Russian domestic market is adapting to this situation. And actually the Western sanctions, in the long term, it's more medium term, sort of acted as a sort of pushing effects for local products to be developed. So you can see that some firms, for instance, I think around Moscow are now developing a local cheese or these type of products that usually were imported from France, Italy, and so on. So you can see that the Russian market is adapting.
Sure. So that's an interesting point, because your argument is actually that economic sanctions that were imposed on Russia by Western powers to harm the Russian economy, in some instances, has actually helped to help the Russian economy in terms of boosting domestic production. But that, I suppose, Caroline, comes to the cost of European exporters of agricultural products, who have therefore lost a consumer base in Russia. I mean, another important, I think, economic consideration when we think about West-Russian relations is the impact of cheap gas supplies from Russia. So Russia is among the world's largest exporters of natural gas. In fact, I think it's world number one. And as we know, a lot of European member states, particularly Germany, but other countries like Italy too, are big consumers of cheap Russian natural gas. So there's a really important sort of economic component to West Russian relations, especially in the European context, because obviously, maintaining gas supplies from Russia to those member states in the EU, which are sort of affordable, because it's cheap gas that's coming through, that's only going to help European economies. So it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of Biden-Putin meeting, and how Biden sort of actually backed down, much to the dislike of some US senators, but he's backed down when it's come to sanctioning companies involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. So that would indicate that actually the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project is going to go ahead, because there isn't that sort of robust US pressure in the form of sanctions. So I would argue, Anne-Caroline, that the West Russia relations at the moment, from an economic standpoint, are not really going to change when it comes to the provision of natural gas. So the only country I could see suffering from the lack of sanctions imposed by the US on Nord Stream 2 is Ukraine, because Nord Stream 2 basically builds a pipeline that goes through the Baltic states, right, and then brings direct gas supplies to Germany. So what that means is that gas supplies that are currently going through Ukraine will cease to go through Ukraine. So Ukraine won't benefit from the transit fees. So the Ukrainian economy will suffer, right? Because it depends quite a lot on transit fees of gas pipelines going through the country. But it also means that actually, from an economic standpoint, I mean, the Russians could are in a stronger position to shut the gas pipes going into Ukraine, right, for political expediency reasons, whilst not undermining economic relations with big importers of natural gas like Germany. I think that's an interesting point that's worth making, because the consumption of gas, well, at a consumer level, it impacts the ability for consumers to heat their homes, to use gas, using gas boilers, to cook their food using gas cookers and so on. And we know that in Ukraine, whenever the Russians have turned off the gas in the past, it's led to deaths, in the winter, because Ukrainians haven't been able to heat their homes properly. So it's that serious, and it's that real when it comes to the lives of individuals and how they're economically impacted by West Russian relations. But there's another sort of dimension I want to explore with you, Anne-Caroline, which is the impact of West Russian relations on democracy and on elections in Western countries. Can we expect the sort of hybrid warfare and the form of disinformation undertaken by Russia to continue vis-a-vis Western powers?
Well, Thomas, yes, because today, with the emergence of internet, basically, I would say that conflict and wars are sort of changed shape. And now you can actually conduct a war or conflict, or you can put down a country using the internet. You don't need to physically invade the country. So it's much more sort of subtle mean. And of course, we have it's always hard to prove that it's a government that is behind a misinformation campaign, disinformation campaign, fake news campaign. So it's really hard for the West to actually defend and say the Russian government is behind it, because you don't have official proof. But you can locate the hackers and say they are based in Russia. After, you need to prove whether they have ties with the Russian government, but that's another story. But when we think about Russian misinformation, we actually, and if our listeners want to have a look on the internet, you have plenty of articles that started to emerge. And I think one of the famous example is the famous Internet Research Agency that was created, I think, in 2013. And this name started to appear in media in 2014. And it's located in St. Petersburg, Russia. It recently, basically this research agency is actually doing sort of using social media platforms to promote a certain narrative. And so it criticizes, for instance, Alexei Navalny's trying to discredit Putin's
Quickly for our listeners and Caroline, Alexei Navalny was a leading opposition figure in Russia who has actually been incarcerated due to his political opposition. And you know, he was a key figure in galvanizing opposition and protests against the Putin regime. But, you know, like what Putin's done with many of his critics and opponents in the past, he's locked him up, and we'll see what happens to him next. But sorry, it's always worth mentioning that for our listeners.
Yeah, so you see, this research agency is actually serving, in a way, the Putin administration, because it's sort of a putting content that is pro-Kremlin. Another example worth looking at would be the secondary infection campaign. It's a campaign that ran for 6 years, so it was quite long, from 2014 till 2020. And they were using fake accounts, and they were trying to exploit the divides, because this is what it's all about, seeking division and exploiting the divisions that are already present in a society, heightening them in order to make the overall situation go explosive. You are basically using the eruptive nature of our connected societies today to make an explosive cocktail. That's what you're doing. So if you look at the secondary infection campaign, it was actually active on the US election of 2016, the French presidential election of 2017. And it was even doing a sort of campaign to discredit the World Anti-Doping Agency that had been accusing Russian athletes of doping. So there was a doping scandal, and this sort of secondary infection campaign was trying to find new legitimacy. So it's all about using the blurry lines in order to instigate doubts within people's mind, which is a really, really effective tool, I have to say. And as a result of this, just to mention, if the listeners are interested, the EU has developed a sort of database that wants to debunk what they call misleading pro-Kremlin content. I think it's what was put on their website. Called UVS Disinfo. So that is something that seeks to sort of fact check, because I think that's one of the main points here. Always try to fact check the information you're reading.
Yeah, absolutely. Fact checking is key, and it's interesting that the European Union's response to disinformation campaigns by the Russian state has been to debunk fake news myths and so forth. That's a really interesting response to that threat, which is a real threat that impacts the lives of individuals ultimately. Because as we always argue at Polis and Caroline, when it comes to fake news, misinformation, disinformation, it undermines the health of democracy. It undermines the ability to have civil conversations where we can respect one another's right to have a difference of opinion. It sows discord and it sort of can fundamentally just undermine our ability to have a discourse that's friendly and healthy and constructive. And given we've just talked, Anne Caroline, about the real implications of West Russian relations on our economies, on our democracies, we need to now discuss what we can expect next when it comes to West Russian relations, because clearly they're important. So what can we expect to unfold? So if you want to kick off with explaining what we can anticipate when it comes to the future of US-Russian relations, I think that will be really helpful for our listeners.
Well, what we can foresee is that I don't think the relationship between the US and Russia can improve, but they will never be, for now, under the Biden administration, they will not be, let's say we can manage to avoid eruption of tensions by trying to work with Russia. And this is what happened during last month during the Geneva summit. You can see that the meeting between Biden and Putin was actually really tense. But I think when Putin took off the meeting, he said the conversation has been constructed. So in a sense, you can say that they are willing to discuss important topics such as the topic of weapons and cyber attacks. And I think during that summit, Biden provided a list of sectors that couldn't be attacked by Russian hackers or Russian cyber attackers. And Biden tried to actually sort of put red lines and said, and actually also said that he could take action if these critical infrastructures were being attacked. So I think as long as conversation is going on, again, I like to end the podcast always with positive thoughts. As long as conversation is going on, we can say it's positive. So we can find a way to cooperate in the weapon on the weapon dimension and the cyber attack area.
No, that's a good point. So as long as dialogue continues between the US administration and Russia, then maybe relations won't enter a deep freeze. But it's interesting, Anne Caroline, you like to finish on a more positive note. But I'm sometimes a bit more pessimistic. And one thing I'm wondering is actually what's next when it comes to EU relations towards Russia? Because at the moment, you could argue that the relationship between the EU and Russia has always been one of pragmatism. So on the one hand, the EU has always defended its economic interests. You know, Russia is is still a sizable economy. It's on Europe's doorstep. And as I mentioned earlier, when it comes to the provision of cheap natural gas, that's a huge benefit for a lot of European economies. At the same time, you know, European member states have always been ready to be critical when it comes to Russian military aggression, like in Syria, like with the annexation of Crimea, when it comes to Russian undermining of, you know, European values and norms. We've seen this when, you know, Merkel has been vocally opposed in the past to Russian activity when it comes to LGBTQ plus rights, with the attack on gay men in Chechnya, for instance. So, you know, the EU has always sort of had this careful balancing act between defending its economic interests when it comes to relations with Russia, but also, you know, being vocal and critical when it comes to Russian attacks on European, you know, values and democratic norms. But look, it's been an interesting conversation on a really important topic, and hopefully we've highlighted that geopolitical tensions between big, you know, states like Russia and like key Western powers can actually have a real impact on the lives of individuals. I'll be in the virtual armchair next week with Jeremiah. Jeremiah is the head of research at Policy Analysis. He has a big understanding of technology issues, because he's worked in big US tech companies. He's got really interesting expertise on that side of things. But to be completely honest, there's so much that Jeremy and I could potentially talk about. At Policy Analysis, we're constantly sort of monitoring key political developments. And given politics is increasingly volatile and unpredictable, there's just a lot to talk about. So actually, you know, we've been running this podcast for a few weeks now, and I'm keen to get ideas from you guys, from our listeners. So if there's anything that you want myself and Jeremiah to discuss for episode 6 of the Polis podcast, then please get in touch. You can contact us through social media or through email with your suggestions and your thoughts, and we'll do our best to through popular opinion and through your own views to discuss a topic that meets your interest. But thanks so much for listening, and thank you, Anne Caroline, for joining me today.
Thank you, Thomas. It was really great to talk to you.
We hope you enjoyed this Polis podcast episode. At Polis Analysis, we are fully devoted to helping individuals better navigate the political world. So we would love to hear your thoughts, and please do share any suggestions you may have for future Polis podcast episodes. Follow the Polis podcast channel on Spotify to access our weekly episodes. And if you want to better navigate the political world with accessible, fact-based and impartial analysis of global politics, then sign up to our free newsletter at www.polisanalysis.com. And don't forget to follow us Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.